Good afternoon. So last time we went through more examples of how monitors work. We said that we have this sort of general pattern for using monitors where we lock the lock that was part of the monitor, and we do this loop where we wait. Well, we need to wait for whatever condition we're waiting for using some condition variable. And when we're waiting, we're going to put ourselves on the list of waiting threads that's associated with that condition variable, and also unlock the lock so things can change that condition, because the thing we're waiting on is going to be something about the shared data that we have this convention that we're never going to look at without getting the lock first. So then once we're done waiting, we're going to exit from that loop after no longer needing to wait, and with the lock held, so we're going to be able to do something with the shared data. And after we do that, we might change whether other threads that are waiting still need to wait. So we're going to check for do they still need to wait, and if the answer might be no, we're going to use signal and or broadcast, depending on the details of our circumstance. If we're unsure, we're going to use broadcast to have them wake up and check, do I still need to wait, and do this same process. And once we do that, we'll unlock the mutex and release the shared data for other threads to take their turn to do something with that. We also looked at this kind of alternate set of tools for doing these sort of general things with thread, with sort of thread synchronization, which was a counting semaphore. So these combined the operation of ensuring exclusion, that we take turns one at a time to access something, and the operation of waiting for some event to happen into kind of one basic operation, which dealt with these counting semaphores. Well, I guess one basic abstraction with two operations. And our two operations were both based on manipulating this internal non-negative number that we can thought of. They had this analogy of like reserved library books, that the number might represent the number of books that are available to reserve. And we had our up operation, which increments that number. Says there's one more book in our analogy. And the down operation, which decrements the number, but with an exception, that because it's non-negative, if the number is currently zero, the decrement operation is going to wait for it not to be zero. So we never make the number become negative. And what's nice about these counting semaphores is that for some problems, they're relatively natural because we can think of something we want to count, something we want to do bookkeeping for, and we just insert the up and down operations where we want to adjust that number we're doing bookkeeping on. And kind of naturally, we'll just wait at the right times, assuming we choose the right things to count. And what's the right thing? Something where when the count's zero, we want to wait for something else to be available. And finally, we talked a bit about transactions. So transactions were this higher level abstraction that some systems provide, where rather than needing to reason about how do I make sure that all these things coordinate with locks and worry about deadlock and all that, we just say, here's a bunch of things. I'd like these to happen all at once. And the system has some strategy to make that happen. And this is something that's common in things like databases, where the database will have a bunch of effort to figure out how to synchronize things and make it work out that these operations appear to happen all at once, even though obviously that's not really what's happening as far as executing them and changing bits in memory and disk and so on. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so looking at the quiz answers from last time, there's probably a few things I should go over. So quiz one, option A, if you lock a mutex twice, this usually hangs. And that's what that option was saying we do. There are some types of mutexes which don't do this. They are not the default option for pthread mutex. And if we think of what our definition of a lock is, you know, if I have the lock, I can't get the lock again because only one thing, you can only get the lock once until it's unlocked. And there was also 1D was not a case for a hang. And if we think of our deadlock criteria, we can figure out why. Is that we have actually a consistent order here, because these calls will acquire A then B for the first one, A then C for the second one, and B then C for the second one. So we actually have a consistent order that we lock A, then we lock B if we want to, then we lock C if we want to. And we never deviate from this order, so we won't get a hang as a result of a deadlock. Yes?
What would the best way be to handle the case where it's A and A, if that makes sense?
Question, what's the best way to handle the case where it's A and A? So one solution is something called, a so-called recursive lock, or mutex, which you can make a pthread mutex TB, but it's not the default, which is that a mutex where it will detect if you're locking from the same thread that locked it and allow you to do that. So that's one option that you can handle. The other is that usually when you think of like what this means, the semantics aren't very clear. And in particular, if we think of the append to array function, the append to array function is the code that was in the function that doesn't actually work for appending to itself, I believe, because it does something like a data equals malloc, you know, and then it does a memcopy from a data, or it does realloc, right? It does reallocs the data. But then it does a memcopy data plus a size to a data, I guess, x plus size plus a size from a data plus a size after we've done that realloc. And this is a case where we probably want to be very careful, because I don't actually remember whether the original code handles this case correctly. But if we, here, like if we were to set a size to the new size before this, we'd be in big trouble, right? Because we're using the new size for the mem copy, for how much we copy, and that wouldn't work out very well. So I think we end up not doing that, but because of things like that, I would be very concerned that just using a recursive mutex wouldn't be enough. You need to look at your code and say, do I actually handle the case where you're appending something to itself? Because usually, if you aren't thinking about that, you know, you might be confusing things by updating things in a not careful way. But yes, there's something called a recursive mutex for the cases where the behavior you want is, if I'm locking something I already have locked, just increment a counter to remember how many times I need to unlock. Does that answer your question? Or other questions? Okay. Then I'll also talk about 3 and 4. So in this example, we have this dequeue both function, which is supposed to wait until we had an A and a B to dequeue. And we could see from how enqueueB works that this must use both available. It wasn't actually written in the code, but enqueueB only signals both available. In order for this function to wake up when we have 1A and we just enqueued a B and it's waiting, both available better be what it's waiting on. Can't wait on A available, because it can only wait on one thing at a time. And this meant that in QE, just in case we have there be 1B and 0As, and we call in QA, it's going to need to make something waiting on both available wake up. So it has to at least sometimes signal and broadcast both. So that's why the option of just doing A available wasn't sufficient, because something in DQ both could just hang when we know it's not supposed to. And it could hang even, you know, even when there's no one calling DQA. And we can't do, one of the options was checking both available. Both available was a condition variable. Despite the name, condition variables are lists of waiting threads. They can't be compared to zero in a useful way or any other value. And I wrote that code because I've had people do that on exams a bunch. They are not conditions, despite the name. They're just list of threads. Yes?
Say A is not available, but B is, wouldn't it be better to check if A is available first? Because it would be kind of wasteful to just wake up a thread if it's open up.
So the question isn't there a way of doing this so we avoid waking up a thread when we in QA and there's no B? And yes, that might be something that would be an optimization we can make, which I did not make in the question. How you actually do it is a little subtle, because the naive way of doing, so your naive solution would be, if on in QA, and if one B signal is, I guess, greater than or equal to 1B, right? Signal, probably works, but you have to think carefully through, what if the thing I signal doesn't get to run right away? Do I handle it? So for example, greater than 1B probably works. Doing the, but if you were to do greater than 1B and exactly 1A now, after we enqueued, that probably doesn't work, because you could wake up one thing and then you enqueue another thing, so there's 2As, and you fail to wake something up for the second one. And that you could enqueue before something dequeues. So you need to be very careful with that, which is why I didn't make it in the question, do that, the version in the question, but yes, you could absolutely do it more efficiently. What question would it be most appropriate? I meant most appropriate of the options we provided, and the none of the above was none of these would work. But if you selected that, it said explain in comments, so we will grade you appropriately regardless. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? And I see a typo on the slide here. So, one, before putting value, this should be zero. So, last question was asking, what's the initial value of semaphores? We didn't go over much. So if we look at this example, we have this weight here. And the way this wait should work is we want the wait to be able to happen right away, that before we've done anything, we want to be able to put a value there. So that means that value empty should start at 1, because we want it to happen, but we only want it to happen once before we retrieve the value. So it should start at 1. And value ready, we want to start at 0. I wrote 1 on this slide because of a copy-paste error. 0, because when this function first runs, we want it to wait at that first wait here until something else puts a value in. So its initial value should be 0. Okay, so questions? Okay, so, and briefly, some honest feedback to some people saying, could we drop a homework? If I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that. Announce that way earlier in the semester. I'm skeptical of the value of dropping the lowest assignment as a way to reduce workload, because I think for the students who most need the workload reduced, the way they're going to look at the last assignment is, gosh, I better do this because of my assignment grade, not this is optional for me. And that's less true for some of the students who don't need the drop as much, but for the ones who need it most, I think it's like kind of worse off, or just as bad at least. Okay, so before I move on to our next topic, I want to correct something I didn't do correctly about transactions, talking about the optimistic strategy. So when I introduced this, one way of implementing transactions is that we kind of do all the operations in the transaction, but don't actually store them yet, and we record all the values we read. And I wrote that we copy the read values, and that certainly works, but maybe a more realistic way of thinking about this is like we have version numbers, or something equivalent to version numbers for all the values we read. So we have this transaction where we said, you know, we're going to, I don't have the operate, we're going to like have a begin operation, we're going to, you know, read account balance, then write account balance. So we'll record the values we read, and we'll record like which version of the value did we read. And then when we get to end, we'll make sure that nothing else interfered. And this is how we'll provide axiomicity, that if it's the case that some other operation snuck in between, at least based on our read version numbers, which maybe isn't 100% thorough, but that's a topic for an advanced database concurrency control class. If it seems like they're out of sync, we'll just try it again until it works. So this is kind of a way without locking during most of the transaction. You probably would still be doing some locking in this kind of end transaction operation, but that would only be after you've computed all the values you expect to write, so you don't have to do as much work and get like exactly where you want to write them, and so on. Yeah?
Is it this kind of like caching where you keep track of what has changed if it's the same location, and then once you've done with everything, you take the last version of it and actually...
So isn't this related to caching and how we do... How we track like what we want to evict?
Yeah.
So it's a similar idea. We're keeping copies of the values we're working on in a special place. So it's similar to caching in that sense. I wouldn't say it's not like caching in the sense that, well, we have to keep everything for correctness. So caching, like, we're kind of being sloppy all the time. And that, like, it doesn't really matter if we decide to get rid of a value. Like, we'd like to avoid it, but we don't have to worry about it. Here, we actually have to keep all the values we're reading, for example. But if you're thinking of this in terms of caching, there have been systems that implement something called hardware transactional memory, where they provide transactions like of this sort of thing in hardware. And a lot of why that's practical to implement is because a lot of the machinery used for caches you can reuse to do this in hardware. These ideas were maybe popular like a decade ago. They've kind of fallen out of favor, probably because they're... we're going to talk about some hardware security things like Spectre and Meltdown, and maybe they're not so great for those. Other questions? Okay, so that's on transactions. And as a final thing about threading, so our lab tomorrow is about something called OpenMP. So we talked about pthreads, which is kind of this low-level threading interface. We have ways of starting and stopping threads individually. We have ways of synchronizing between threads. And a lot of our threading cat programs have these common patterns, similar to what you saw in the life assignment in my examples. Like one key thing we often want to do to utilize multiple cores is divide up like a loop among threads. And OpenMP is a library which is focused on providing higher level tools like divide this loop among threads. So for example, in OpenMP, one of the things you'll see in the lab is that you can mark a loop with this pragma saying OpenMP parallel 4, and it's going to say, okay, I'll divide that loop up among threads. Just do the whole thing. So, and probably a similar pattern to something you did in the life assignment. And it has some other patterns like this where it has sort of these higher level tools that are built from the functionality that you kind of dealt with in the life assignment for coordinating between threads. questions on sort of my brief overview of what OpenMP is. Okay, so we've talked a bunch about parallelism where we're running multiple threads, we're running multiple streams of instructions, and we have hopefully hardware that can actually do, you know, separate streams of instructions at the same time. We're going to talk for most of the rest of the semester about a different way of exploiting parallelism, which is going to be within a processor running a single stream of instructions, single thread. And to talk about that, we need to refresh ourselves, I hope refresh, about what processors do. And I have my simple processor diagram, which hopefully isn't too divergent from what you hopefully remember from CS01. So I have a program counter here. I have this cache, this is instruction cache, and this D's dollar sign is data cache in my processor. And basically what my processor does to execute an instruction is our program counter has the address of the instruction. We send that to the instruction cache, and we use the information we get from the instruction to figure out what registers to read, and we use the registers to read information from the instruction to do some sort of calculations. And those calculations may or may not feed into the data cache somehow, and then we might get a value from the data cache and rewrite some things, which might be the results of our calculations or values from the data cache, into our register file. And we do this every cycle. And at the same time as we're doing the instruction work, we set the program counter to point to the next instruction. And here I'm kind of omitting the logic for jumps and calls. So we're just adding the length of each instruction to advance to the next one. So as sort of a more concrete illustration, so let's say I'm running this add instruction, adding R8 and R9. So, and it's at address 100. So our PC is going to contain 100. We're going to send that to our instruction cache. And we're going to get from our instruction cache that, oh, the registers 8 and 9 are the ones we want to read. We're going to send that to our register file. And our register file is going to figure out, oh, OK, this means I need to get you the values of register 8 and 9, which were initially 800 and 900. So we'll have those coming into this math circuit. This math circuit will use those values combined with presumably something in the instruction saying add. It's an add instruction. Figure out, oh, I need to add those together and get the sum, which is, I should write the correct sum consistently on this slide. The sum of 1100 in hex, and we'll send that to the register file as the thing to write, and it's going to do that update. And at the same time, we're going to compute our next instruction is at address 108. We'll send that into the program counter, and this is all the stuff that's going to happen for a clock cycle. So, you know, I'm showing, you know, work that happens in one clock cycle, so we compute the values we want to write. We also compute the next PC, and that's our clock cycle. And then we move on to the next instruction, and ultimately this instruction here, we're going to have address 108. We're going to learn that it needs to read from register 10. We're going to get the value of register 10, which is 1000. We're going to do some math to compute, oh, we need to access the data cache at address 2234 based on the other information in the instruction. We're going to get out the value there and write it to register 11. And kind of our notion of what's happening in this instruction, if we think of the add instruction, we have some sort of clock signal. So this is our clock signal. And let's say, you know, at this point in our clock signal, we have the PC equals 100. And as this goes through, we're going to be doing the instruction cache read. Then we're going to do the register file read. Then we're going to do this math here, and then we're going to do the register file write, and that's going to be what we're going to spend a clock cycle running this instruction in this single cycle design here. And then once that cycle's over, we'll move on to the next instruction, have the same kind of set of steps that we're going to end up performing. So questions about this review of what our single cycle processor should do? Yes?
So one cycle only goes through the instruction cache, the register, and that. What about the data cache?
What about the data cache? So in the case of instructions that use the data cache, that's also going to be part of this time. So maybe I should draw that. But for this add instruction, that doesn't matter. But I'll just draw it kind of as a dotted line there. So we have some time in our clock cycle reserved for the case where we do need to go through the data cache, even though that might not happen for every instruction. It might not be important for every instruction. But our clock cycle is going to be set based on the kind of the worst case, because generally we're not going to have the circuitry to like detect what type of instruction it is and adjust the clock cycle accordingly. That is physically possible, but apparently not very efficient. Yes?
So the PC and instruction cache happen on like the rising edge?
Question, the PC and instruction cache happen on the rising edge? So there are multiple types of registers we could have. I'm assuming we have registers which are what would be called positive edge triggered, meaning that they change on the rising edge, but you could have registers which are triggered by other parts of the clock cycle. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How do instructions that take one clock cycle do you divide them?
So the question, how do instructions that take more than one clock cycle work? So this design doesn't handle those instructions. And there are multiple options for implementing that. But yeah, this design just doesn't handle those. We could imagine adding some circuitry, here to maybe do things differently, to not advance the PC all the time, which would probably be the first step for if we had some instructions which like needed extra time for computation. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about something that seems maybe a little inefficient here. So something you might notice is that in this kind of design, during kind of the first part of our clock cycle, we have the instruction cache doing some work. And then for the rest of the clock cycle, the instruction cache isn't really doing anything. It's like holding a value that we need, but it's not working for most of the clock cycle. And the same is true of some other components. Like if we think of this component that does additions, this math component here, it's working for, I should do this, it's working for part of the clock cycle, but the rest of the clock cycle is not really doing anything. And this seems kind of wasteful. And we're going to have an idea to address this, and I'm going to introduce this idea with an analogy. So let's say I have some laundry to do. So I'm going to take my light color clothes. I'm going to put them in my washer, wait for that to finish, take them out of my washer, put them in my dryer, wait for that to finish, take them out of the dryer, fold them all up. Okay, finally done with those. Now I can move on to the next load, take my darker color clothes, put them in the washer, take them out, put them in the dryer, take them out, fold them all up, and then I've done all my laundry. Can anyone think of a way I could have done this maybe more efficiently? Yeah?
Put your colored laundry in the washer right after you take the whites out, and you can sort of move that diagonal over.
Yeah, so you're saying, gosh, why I can use the washer, move this right over here, because I can use the washer right away after it's done being used for the whites, for the colors. So why wouldn't I do that? And indeed, that I can do, and probably any one of you doing laundry would not use the way I proposed here. You wouldn't say, gosh, I'm using the dryer now, can't put anything in the washer. That's not how it works. So we want to do something more like this. And I could fit a whole other load of laundry in there. And we're going to call this idea, we're going to apply this idea to our circuit. We're going to call this pipelining. And what we can think of as happening here is that once I'm done with one step, I move on immediately to do something else with that step. And here, we're doing loads of laundry. We're going to apply this to instructions. So once one instruction's done using, say, the instruction cache, we're going to have the next instruction use it right away, just like once I'm done with one load of laundry using the washer, we're going to have another load use it right away. So something to notice here is that I didn't exactly get a full utilization out of my washer. Okay. If I look at this chart here, I have a bunch of time during which my washer isn't being used. Kind of this wasted time. If I'm thinking, am I getting 100% efficiency out of my washer? Well, not really. And this is because, well, you know, I have to wait for this dryer. And if you're thinking about how fast dryers are, maybe it's more realistically like this. So I'm spending a bunch of time where, well, you know, I have my stuff done in the washer, but I can't actually move it on to the dryer because, well, I only have one dryer. I can't really can't put another load in it at the same time. So I have this wasted time. And so this is waste. And if you look at, okay, how long does it take me to do a load of laundry? Well, because of this, it takes me longer. Each load takes me longer. But if I'm looking at how long each load takes, now it takes a little over 2 hours. Whereas before, without this wasted time where I was waiting for the dryer to be free, it took a little under 2 hours. So, you know, if I was introducing this to you, I'd say, yeah, so I'm doing my laundry in this more efficient way. Every load takes a little over 2 hours instead of a little under 2 hours. But that's not what we care about. We don't actually care that each load of laundry takes longer because the time from when we start a load to when we end a load isn't what we really care about when we're doing laundry. We care about how long does it take to do all the laundry. And the same kind of thing is going to be true in our processor, that I don't care how long it takes to run each individual instruction. I care how long it takes to run my program. My program has thousands, maybe millions of instructions to run. And we're not going to care if there's some waste that much, you know, if we're doing more instructions. So the thing we want to measure isn't how long does it take from start to finish. This is an interesting number. We're going to call it latency. It's the time from beginning to end. But this is not what we really care about. What we really care about is what we'll call throughput. And there's a bunch of ways we can measure throughput. So when we have kind of a slowest stage here, like in this case our dryer, it kind of determines how fast everything can be. That if I'm doing the washer, I need to wait for the dryer to be available, so I can't be any faster than the dryer is. If I'm working the folding table, I don't have anything to fold until the dryer is done. So every stage before the dryer is going to be as slow as the dryer is because it's going to end up waiting. If we had some pre-washer, it would also be waiting because it would be waiting for the washer to be free, which would be waiting for the dryer to be free. And everything after this slowest stage, the dryer, is as slow as the dryer because it's waiting for the dryer to give it something. So it ends up being the case if we measure, say, how long it is between when we finish loads of laundry or how long it is between when we start loads of laundry or when we start any of these steps, they're always going to be basically the same number once we get started. So observe here that I'm assuming we're just doing loads of laundry continuously. So we have this first load that our initial whites have to wait for, and so on. But if we're doing loads of laundry continuously, you know, doesn't matter where we measure, we're going to have the same rate, everyone, ends up being in sync with our slowest step, which is this driver. And usually if we're measuring throughput, we're going to measure it as far as sort of not amount of work per unit time. Okay, questions about this? Yes? Can I say, why is it important to be synced up? So we're just going to end up being synced up naturally. And the way of thinking about this is that, you know, I can't actually advance from the washer stage to this dryer stage until after the dryer is free. So I'm going to end up having my washer run as fast as my dryer. If I had a stage before my washer, you know, if I was ready here, I'm going to have to wait for the washer to be free, which is not going to happen until the dryer is free. So everything before them is kind of going to cascade and end up being synced up with the speed of that dryer because it's the slowest thing. And the same is true with everything after. So it's not that we have to be in sync, it's that we're going to end up in sync even if we might say, maybe there's some way of being faster than the dryer. Well, not really. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, will throughput always be proportional to the slowest component? In this type of pipeline design, yes. And that's because everything has to go through every step. So if, like, we had two dryers, right, you could avoid this problem. That's not something that we have in this sort of setup. Yes?
Can you use, like a basket to store the white rows and then start to tell us what you're going to do, right?
So question is, couldn't I say, so in this, I'm assuming that I have to keep stuff in the washing machine until I can move it to the dryer. Couldn't I move this somewhere and then start the colors early? And let's think about whether that actually helps us or not. So it lets us use the washer earlier, but then if I want to keep using the washer, I need to put the colors somewhere. I want to keep using the washer, I need to put the sheets somewhere. And ultimately, we aren't going to actually finish anything earlier because we're just going to have a longer line at the dryer. So it doesn't help us to try to sneak in something earlier, you know, kind of in the long run. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
What do you mean by
What I mean by pipeline latency as opposed to normal latency? So you're meaning on this slide, I talked about the normal latency versus the pipeline latency. So the pipeline latency is how long it actually took when I had to worry about other things in my pipeline, other things in my kind of assembly line style of doing laundry, versus if I didn't have to worry about it, well, I wouldn't be waiting from when the washer finished to having the dryer available. So I have that organization of the steps. So I do the washer, then immediately do the dryer, then immediately do the folding table, and that was the time it took. And that was the time, basically, we had for our original, you know, obviously silly way of doing laundry. So that it was actually faster if you were measuring how long does each load take. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we're gonna apply this idea of what we call pipelining, this kind of assembly line fashion. We're gonna divide things up into steps. We're gonna do one step for the first thing. Then we're gonna do the second step for the second thing while doing the first step for the second step for the first thing while doing the second step for the first one. We're gonna see that. We're gonna apply this same idea to our processor. So to make this work with our processor, we're gonna need to divide up our processor into steps. We need to have an equivalent of a washer, dryer, and folding table. And I'm going to show you probably the most traditional division, something that was common in kind of early processors of this design, and is most commonly taught. And I'm going to divide the work of the instruction into these steps, which I'm going to call fetch, decode, execute, memory, and write back. These are not the best names for these steps. In particular, decode is where we read registers, which is maybe not what you think of when you think of decode, but these are the traditional names for these steps that you'll see used everywhere, so we're going to use them to be consistent with that. So our steps are, we have this fetch step where we do stuff with the instruction cache and also compute the next instruction. We have our decode step where we read registers, and maybe we do some work about like manipulating, you know, what operation does this instruction do information. We have the execute step where we do any of the math we need. We have the memory step where we do any data cache stuff. And we have the write back step where we write the register values. So I want to divide my circuit into these steps. And what you might say is, okay, so can we just advance the clock cycle faster and just have this happen, right? Can we just send something new to fetch instead of every that cycle time, like every a fifth of that time? And the answer is no. And the problem is that if we send a new value into fetch, then it's going to start outputting new values here. And in order for us to read registers, we need to have a stable number there. The number can't change. We can't be computing a new number while you're trying to read, you know, if we're trying to read from register 8 and 9, if that's what you expect here, this is 8 and 9, we can't have that changing to, say, 10 while you're trying to read it, because probably the register file doesn't like that. The register file needs to see 8, 9, or 10. It can't see, like, 8, 9 turning into 10. It's not going to work if we do that. So we need to have some way of having stable inputs to each of these components, even though we want the previous component to be working on the next thing, not the thing that they're supposed to be working on. And so the way we'll do that is we'll add a bunch of extra registers, which we'll call pipeline registers. And the reason I'm doing this is I want to store the, you know, if you want to read registers 8 and 9, I'm going to store 8 and 9 in here while we're reading that, oh, the next instruction uses register 10. And this makes sure that we have sort of separation between, you know, the multiple different instructions we're working on. We're going to have that between every set of stages. And this also means, because of how registers work, that our clock signal is going to tell us when we move on from one stage to the next. Because every time we have that rising edge, assuming we have positive edge triggered registers, the registers are going to read in a new value, and therefore we're going to advance to the next instruction. So let's look at how this might work. So let's say, so here's this a little set of instructions we're going to run, and I've listed our cycle number, so we're going to have a common clock cycle, and that clock cycle is going to make us, when we reach the end of the clock cycle, we're going to advance to the next step, and everyone's going to advance all at the same time, which means that initially, this add instruction, we're going to do the fetch step, what we'll call the fetch stage, then we're going to do the decode stage, then we're going to do the execute stage, then the memory stage, then the write back stage. And while that's happening, we're going to also start the next instruction during the next cycle. So let's look at the state during cycle 0. So during cycle 0, our register file is outputting, sorry, our PC is outputting address 100. And this means that our fetch unit here is going to output that this is 8,9 of the registers you want to read, and that it's an add. But that information is going to be computed during this cycle. But we aren't going to pass it on to the decode stage yet. And the reason for that is that, you know, in general, something else will be working there. We haven't advanced decode to that instruction. So then we're going to have the rising edge of the clock. And the way our registers work, we're going to copy their inputs into them. So this 108 is going to become the new value of the PC. This 8 and 9 is going to become the new value of this register, and this add is going to also be stored, being passed on for later use in the execute stage. And so that means during our next cycle, We're going to have 8 and 9 going into our decode. We're going to have our PC outputting address 108 instead of 100. So our fetch step is doing this second instruction, this move, and our decode step is reading the registers for the add instruction. So we're working on two instructions at once. And the reason this is going to be faster is that previously our clock cycle had to be long enough that we could do the fetch and decode all in one cycle. Now it doesn't need to be that long. Now it's going to be shorter, because it just needs to be long enough to do the reading of registers and also or do the reading of from the instruction cache. It doesn't need to do both at the same time. Both in one cycle, I should say. We're doing both at the same time, but in kind of for different instructions, so they can start kind of overlap with each other. You can see here that we're decoding, reading registers while we're fetching. So we're going to end up here that coming into the register between decode and execute, we're going to have our values for register 8 and 9. Coming into the registers for decode, we're going to have 10 and 11, and the part of the move instruction. So we're going to get all the values ready from our fetch step, which is going to be the move instructions values, from our decode step, which is going to be the register values we computed from the add instruction. And then we're going to advance from cycle 1 to cycle 2. So there, we're going to be doing the execute part of the add. So this math machinery here is going to compute the sum of 800 and 900. We're going to read the register value for the move. And we're going to start fetching the next instruction. So we're running three instructions at once now instead of one at a time. And so we're going to read that it's an XOR. And we're also going to prepare that it needs to deal with registers 12 and 13. Question? Yes.
So what if you have, like, for example, if line 100 or line 108, like, relied on the value that brings the output from 100?
So a question you have is, what if instead of using our 10 here, we used our 9? Wouldn't we have a problem? Yes, we would. And we'll talk about how to deal with that problem later very explicitly. And that is indeed something we're gonna have to deal with. Another problem that we'll have to deal with is, what if I had a conditional jump? Like, I don't even have that circuit drawn. How does that work? So we'll talk about both those problems later, and those are indeed gonna make things maybe not as efficient. And definitely not as simple. Other questions? Yeah.
Why is the program counter not in any of the events decode execute memory blocks? Why is it outside of it?
Question, why do I have it outside of it? So just like I have the register values being passed from fetch to decode and decode to execute outside of the blocks, I drew the PC outside of the blocks for fetch because I think of it as being a value passed from fetch to fetch. Does that answer your question? So, like, I don't think it would be wrong to draw it in the box for fetch, but I drew it outside because I think of it, it's kind of like the registers between fetch and decode, but for the input to the fetch stage.
Why doesn't it have a pipeline register for the program counter itself? Is that needed or not?
Question, why does it have a pipeline register for the program counter itself?
Yeah.
So I think of the program counter itself as a pipeline register, just the one before the fetch stage.
Wow.
Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so then we're going to advance from cycle 2 to cycle 3. So here, now we have our sum from our add instruction, which is going to go through this memory step. You might say, wait a moment, the add instruction doesn't need the memory step. Why are we doing that? Well, if there was a memory instruction before the add, we couldn't delay it. If we have a memory instruction before it, we can't delay the previous one. So we can't really skip this memory stage because some instructions need it, and we're going to need to wait for them. So we might as well just do it every time. So even though in this case, our memory step is doing the very simple operation of taking this value and passing it through to the next stage. But we're still going to do it because we're not going to have an easy way of varying the number of stages, because once we have an instruction that uses all the stages, well, we're going to have to wait for it anyways and have to slow all the instructions down. So we might as well just not bother and just have every instruction go through every stage, so we don't have to worry about that. So our add's going to go through this memory stage, do pretty much nothing. Our execute is going to do the calculation of the address for the move. And our decode is going to read some register values for the XOR. And then we're going to move on to the cycle four. And here we're going to finally send the sum we computed earlier to the register file, along with that it goes to register 9. We're going to take the address from the move and compute the value in memory at that address using the data cache. And we're going to do the XOR operation in the execute step. So we're doing multiple instructions at a time. And if I wrote down more instructions, we'd have one, the instruction after the XOR, we'd be reading its registers. And the instruction after that, we'd be fetching it from the memory, from the instruction cache. Some questions about how this timeline works. Okay, so talked about how you need registers. Let's do a thing here. So I have our pipeline here. Let's say our cycle time is 500 picoseconds. What is the latency for one instruction? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so you have a plurality for E, and that's what I got, because the time to finish the instruction is basically the whole, we need to go through all those stages. Now, maybe you quibble, wait a moment, maybe we don't need the whole write-back stage, we need some of it, though. But yes, maybe we don't need the whole write-back stage, maybe therefore it should be slightly less, that would be a good reason to choose E. Questions about that? Okay, so how about the throughput? Question or just looking? No. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? E? Okay, so you have a plurality for B. And that's what I would say is the overall throughput. If we think of continuing this diagram, we're going to have another instruction fetched, another instruction fetched. So we're fetching an instruction every cycle. And once we get started, we're finishing an instruction every cycle. That we finished one instruction by cycle 4, two instructions by cycle 5, three instructions by cycle 6. So yes, we had some time where we weren't doing very many instructions, but overall, once we're running for a while, we're basically going to be finishing one instruction every cycle. So our overall throughput's going to be about one instruction per cycle, and our cycle time is 500 picoseconds. Some questions? How I computed that. Okay, so let's do another exercise where I've drawn this diagram in the wrong place. But we'll draw it by hand later. So let's say here, I started with our five-stage processor, and let's say I double the number of pipeline stages. So instead of having this fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, which we showed here, I'm going to divide each of these stages in half. So we're going to have fetch one, fetch two. So our instruction cache has two halves, we're saying. Decode one, decode two, execute one, execute two, memory one, memory two, write back one, write back two. And we're going to have that be our processor. So I have double the number of pipeline stages because I figured out how to like divide the instruction cache read into two steps. So maybe I have like first the set lookup and then the tag checking. And I figured out how to divide my register read into two steps somehow and so on. So I've just divided everything into two steps. And by doing that, my assumption is that rather than having each step be 500 picoseconds, I have each one be 250 picoseconds. My question is, what's the new throughput now? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, something else? Okay, so consensus for B. Yeah, so now with this new design, we should start doing the first part of the fetch every cycle, and we also should finish the, once we get started, not at the beginning, but once we get started, we should finish the second part of the write back every cycle. So we'll end up with starting and finishing one instruction every 250 picoseconds, our new cycle time. So this question made kind of a bold assumption here, and that was that we could like split up the instruction cache into two halves, and the register file read into two halves, and the register file write into two halves. And maybe that's not realistic. We'll get to that later. But there's another thing that we kind of assume, is that we assume when we split it up in half, we'd half the cycle time. But if you remember what we did when we added pipelining to this processor, we needed to add these registers. And these registers are not free. So let's say the register takes 10 picoseconds to do its work. because physically we can't have a register instantaneously read a value and instantaneously output a value. It's going to take some time to do that. Let's say that time is 10 picoseconds. Then if we want to keep dividing up our stages into smaller pieces, well, this means that our cycle time is not actually going to divide in half, even if we divided the stages perfectly. That, you know, we have take 100 picoseconds of work divided into 50 picosecond pieces. If our register takes 10 picoseconds, well, we haven't nearly half the cycle time. Instead, we get this kind of diminishing returns where, you know, we got not a 2x speed up by doubling the number, we got a, you know, 80%-ish speed up, sort of 100%. And we get these kind of diminishing returns as we kind of asymptotically approach how long it takes that register to work, because that's a component we need to add every time we add more stages. We can also view this, this is showing kind of latency per stage and time per stage. We could also view this in terms of throughput, in which case we're kind of, our throughput keeps approaching the maximum rate at which we can update those registers. We never actually get there. But this assumes that, ignore it, the register is something we can't, like, we need to add, but the logic we could split up perfectly. But that's usually not the case. If we think of our instruction cache, I mentioned, oh, our instruction cache, maybe it really does have two stages. We have one stage where we need to look up the set, and another stage where we need to compare all the tags in the set if we have multiple ways. That's two stages. We could do that in separate clock cycles and have this nice two-stage fetch. But they probably don't take exactly the same amount of time. And if we think of like adding, right? We can probably divide adding a number into two parts, but they're probably not going to be exactly the same amount of time. So what's going to end up happening is that when we divide things up into more clocks, more stages, we're going to end up having the work split up unevenly. That will take your 100 picoseconds of work, and we'll split it into two pieces, but maybe one of those pieces takes 60 picoseconds and another takes 45. You know, because, well, you know, we split it up into two pieces, but the first one was bigger than the second, and previously they kind of overlapped a little bit, and now they can't. Because we have this register in between. And this is commonly something that we'll see happening. So we'll end up with sort of more and more diminishing returns from adding these extra stages. And these two factors are going to limit how much we want to do this trick of dividing up our processor into these smaller stages. So we'll usually target having, you know, not more than 10 of them. There's some processors which have had like 30, but that's probably about as high as you might go, except in cases where there's something about your problem which lets you have a lot more stages usefully. Okay, so questions? Yes. So the question is, when we choose what's in pipeline stages, do we want to choose that based on how much time things take? Absolutely. So because what our goal is that we want these chunks of logic to be as close to evenly split as possible. So if we find out our instruction cache takes 1,000 picoseconds and our adder takes 300, we probably would like, you know, if our adder is going to be in one stage, that our instruction cache we divide up into three to like get about an even split somehow. Does that answer your question?
And like generally speaking, and I recognize it's case by case, is it better to prioritize the, like, for example, in that case, like you would want to split the instruction step into three, you wouldn't want to like merge the adder step with the step surrounding it?
So the question is, in that case where we had an adder that was, say, much faster than an instruction cache, we want to split the instruction cache into three. We wouldn't want to, rather than merging the adder. So both are options which will avoid having our clock cycle have a lot of time that isn't useful. But if we're going to get the best throughput if we can successfully have more pipeline stages, except we'll see that there's some issues related to your, what if we read that register right away, where we might get into trouble. And also, as we add more pipeline stages, we, of course, make our processor more complicated and take up more power and so on. So those are sort of other constraints. And I guess the other thing to mention is that adding pipeline stages, it might not be straightforward to like split up the instruction cache into three pieces, depending on how the instruction cache looks internally, right? Because that's really going to matter what happens inside that we can, you know, save what we're doing and move on to it the next cycle. You know, sometimes that's practical, sometimes that's not. Yeah?
So how are we, like, doing, like, multiple I guess, like, steps at the same time? Like, is it, like, some sort of, like, threading, like, something else?
Question, how are we doing multiple steps at the same time? So in this design, we're taking one program and we're doing different instructions from a single thread in that program at the same time. We're not doing like, but by different instructions at the same time, I mean we're doing the first part of one instruction while doing the second part of another, right? We're not like reading the registers for two different instructions at the same time. We do all of the individual steps in order still. So for example, in this diagram here, I fetch the first instruction, then the second. So I'm still running the instructions in order as far as when I do each step, but I'm kind of interleaving, you're overlapping the steps of the instructions from the same program. Does that answer your question?
So, but is it like, if I have like multiple processors running the instructions?
The question is, are there multiple processors running the instructions? So this is something we do inside one processor core. So I have one program, one thread, one core, and I'm have my components, which make up one processor core, that I'm just dividing up among the instructions we have active, rather than saying that if we're doing this add instruction, I'm reserving all of these components. I'm saying I'm going to first reserve the instruction cache, then the register file read, and so on, rather than reserving all the instructions for the add and then moving on. All the components for the add and then moving on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. Yes. Sorry.
If you have an executed invalid instruction during the pipeline, like you do with a byte by zero or after the state and all that, you don't want to save the remainder instructions from that thread to be executed. But is there a mechanism to basically clear the pipeline?
So the question is there a mechanism to clear the pipeline in case like we have a seg fault or divide by zero or something? Usually there would be. If we think about our pipeline here, well, we're going to detect the seg fault probably here, in which case none of the instructions that are in the earlier stages have really done anything yet. So we can just like clear these pipeline registers and that would be enough. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's introduce our next issue. So we alluded to this earlier. So here I have at R8 R9 and at R9 R8. And if we think of how these end up executing, well, we're going to, why did I skip to? We're going to end up computing R8 plus R9. And if we think of our pipeline diagram, we're going to have this go to fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. The X1 go to fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, you know, offset by one. So we're going to read, for this first instruction, we're going to read the value of, this should be RA, sorry, of 800 and 900. Let's assuming that's the initial values. Then for the second instruction, well, we're going to read 800 and 900. Why are we going to do that? Well, because we think of our timeline. I have know, this is where 800 and 900 are written. You haven't written them yet. So I'm going to read here, I'm going to read 800, 900. Here, I'm going to read 800 and 900. And that's wrong, right? If we think of how this would work on our old processor before we did pipelining, you know, here we'd set R9 would be equal to 1700, and here we compute R8 equals 1700 plus 800. We'd add the value that we just computed because we're supposed to do the first add before the second. But we have this problem that that's not what we're doing anymore. We're actually interleaving them, and we noticed. And this problem is known as a data hazard. We have this case where we're supposed to read this 1700, we haven't written back yet. And therefore, we get the wrong answer. And this seems like a big problem with our pipelining idea. Because to do it, I kind of delayed when the instruction's right. And if we think of what our implementation is, that we're in the pipeline implementation, with our steps, we're reading R8 and R9 for instruction 1, we're reading R9 and R8 for instruction 2, then we're writing the results for instruction 1, then writing the results for instruction 2. And our processor manual that says what an add instruction does, what does it say? Well, it says when we do an add instruction, we read the register values, we add them together, and we write the result before we move on to the next instruction. So what our processor implements is not what we specify. It's not what our documentation for people writing assembly says add instructions to. That documentation says when you do an add instruction, it changes the registers for the next instruction. But it doesn't happen. So questions about this data hazard problem that comes from doing pipelining. Okay. So we have this problem where since our pipeline changed the orders of the reads and writes, we're getting the wrong answer. So I'm going to talk about the simplest solutions, and next time we're going to talk about more practical solutions that are less bad for performance. But the simplest solution is we can change the ISA. The problem is that the ISA specification stupidly wrote that when you do an add instruction, it changes the value of the register for the next instruction. That's not what we meant. What we meant is it changes the value for the instruction 3 after. It should be 4, I think. Sorry, 4 instructions later, but depends on how the register file works. And if we did this, then the compiler would need to know that, well, you can't write that assembly I showed you earlier. You need to add some nops. And this is an approach some real processors have taken, but it's kind of not something people like very much because it makes it hard to change how processors work internally. It turns out that compilers aren't great at taking advantage of this and producing the most efficient programs, and it's also error-prone for manual assembly programming. So another version of this solution is that we can have the hardware insert those nops. It can detect this situation somehow, and rather than fetching a new instruction, it can push a nop through and delay fetching the next instruction. So we have some logic to not always change the program counter, and some logic to, rather than using the instruction we're at to put do nothing values, send that to the decode stage while we're waiting to be able to actually read the register values. And this idea is called stalling. So basically where we just have the hardware detect this situation, insert some nops, which means our pipeline's not gonna get the throughput we wanted anymore, but at least we're computing the right answer. And hopefully we don't have to do this too often because hopefully this situation's uncommon. But we're going to talk about a better solution next time. So some logistical notes. Where did I put my slides on this? Right. So I don't have real slides. So there's a pipelining homework, which I have not covered enough for. So I'm going to delay the due date of the pipelining homework and the following homework a bit. I have to decide whether I'm doing it to the Friday or the next week. If I do it to the next week, I need to have the out of order homework probably due before we go do the final exam review, because I'd really like to be able to talk about it during the final exam review. Just as a warning. That's where I'll finish up.